Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your scrappy but lovable host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show very special guest, biographer, teacher, scholar, writer of many things, SFSU's own Professor Joseph McBride. Welcome back to the show, Joe.
Hi, Pauline. It's great to be back, as always.
Yes. Now, Joe, I know we're friends and you've been on the show a couple of times before, but I also know that the primary reason you agreed to come on the show is so you'd have an excuse to bust out the bowler hat. Am I right?
Yeah, and the cane.
Yeah.
And the big shoes, the floppy shoes.
Lest we forget.
Yeah.
On today's episode, we're talking bowler hats, oversized pants, and silly walks. It occurs to me this could also be Monty Python, but no, we're going back even further in film history to talk about another brilliant Brit, Mr. Charlie Chaplin. Specifically his movie, the 50th film on the Sight and Sound poll, City Lights. That's right, folks. We're almost done with the top 50. I can't believe it. On our previous Sight and Sound entry, Histoire du Cinéma, Charlie and his facial hair became kind of a long-running joke. But now we're going to talk only about Chaplin, and I, for one, promise to leave Godard out of this. I can't make any promises about McBride.
You'll
be all right?
No. There's a Godard quote I want to quote.
Oh, never mind. Yeah. There will be Godard.
I thought of that while I was watching the film again.
Perfect. Fool you.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. Chaplin's films are kind of utilitarian in their shooting style. He's not fancy at all with the camera, but they're beautifully shot and perfectly composed. And somebody said to Chaplin, why don't you have more beautiful shots in your films, more interesting shots? And he said, I am interesting, which I thought was a wonderful comment.
Love it.
And but then Godard once said, some films are true because they're beautiful and others are beautiful because they're true. And he was talking about Rossellini, but I think he could talk about Chaplin. They're beautiful because they're true.
Love it. Love it.
So we've got Godard taken care of.
We've got that checked off the list. I'm glad we got that over with, out front, you know. Filled that quota.
Without a reference to Godard.
It's so true. after Charlie, Joe's going to catch us up on a few of the projects he's been working on, including the soon-to-be-released Criterion Blu-ray of Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight and the Kino Lorber release of John Ford's Three Bad Men. All right, Joe. You ready to dive in?
Yeah.
All right. Hold on to your hat. For today's Sight and Sound entry, we have the 50th greatest movie of all time, Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. Hailed as a masterpiece upon its 1931 release, and the esteem has been growing ever since, City Lights brings Chaplin's iconic The Tramp character back to the screen for more hijinks and heartbreak. In this incarnation, the Tramp encounters a blind girl, played by Virginia Cheryl, who's desperately trying and failing to eke out a living selling flowers on the street. Unable to see the Tramp's shabby clothes or unkempt appearance, the blind girl mistakes him for a big shot when he borrows a wealthy man's car and gives the girl a ride home. The Tramp, being the big, soft-hearted vagabond that we know and love, immediately falls head over heels for the blind girl and resolves to not only make sure that she is properly clothed and fed, but also that she has the means to get a procedure that would cure her of her blindness. The film follows the tramp as he runs the gauntlet trying to find the blind girl the money that she needs. All kinds of trials and tribulations ensue, and somehow the laughs increase with each fresh humiliation. Eventually, the tramp is able to scrounge up the cash for the blind girl, but he pays a steep price for his trouble. He ends up convicted of robbery and sentenced to several months of hard time. The film concludes with a reunion between the freshly sprung tramp and the no longer blind girl. The girl, now sitting pretty and able-bodied in her new flower shop, isn't able to see that it was the tramp's generosity that restored her sight. That being said, she is in a position to be generous, and seeing the tramp's threadbare attire, She offers him a little change. When he refuses, she takes his hand, insisting on giving him the money. And it's then that she recalls the familiar touch of her benefactor. The final shot of the film, one of the most heart-wrenching in cinema history, is a close-up on the tramp just after the look of recognition crosses over the flower girl's face. That, my friends, is how you button up a movie.
I think it's Seiji famously called it the greatest piece of acting and the highest moment in movies.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's why City Lights is rightly considered Chaplin's best film. At least it's the highest one on the Sight and Sound poll. But Joe, what do you think? How do you feel about City Lights?
Well, it's always been one of my favorites, and I think it is his best film. I've seen all his features and a lot of his shorts, and City Lights has a purity and lyrical beauty in the acting and the mood of the film that is really so sublime. He made other great films, of course, The Gold Rush, The Circus, Great Dictator, some of the later works. I love King in New York, which is actually a terrific film. But City Lights is sort of the pinnacle of his art, I think, and The Art of Pantomime on the screen. It's a late silent film. Hardly anybody was making silent films anymore. Actually, in the U.S., he was about the last. Ozu in Japan still made silent films until 1936, but when Chaplin made City Lights, the sound period was starting. He began the film in 1928 and didn't finish it until 31. He was such a painstaking perfectionist, but he was going against the tide, and people thought he was kind of crazy for doing that, but it was successful, and it was kind of a farewell to silent films. He did Modern Times after that in 1936. He made another silent film, but in that he sings a song,
right.
So I wasn't including that. But it doesn't have dialogue otherwise. And City Lights has a musical score that he composed and has some funny sound effects. He makes fun of talking pictures in the first scene where the mayor and a society woman are giving speeches, and they're voices are distorted with funny sound effects like squawking noises that Chaplin actually did himself.
Yeah. That's a nice touch, yeah.
And there's some other sound effects, like he swallows a whistle at one point and he keeps hiccuping with the whistle. It's funny.
Right.
But it's a kind of a statement about silent films. And like when I taught a course on silent films, that sort of stands out as the epitome of the art form. Sunrise is another great, great achievement in silent films, but silent film acting has never been better than in City Lights.
Mm-hmm. When did you first see it?
Oh, I was in college, I think, way back in the 60s. I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and we had a lot of Chaplin films there. And there was still the debate. The debate had already started between the Chaplin fans and the Keaton fans. And Keaton's films came out. They had been kind of missing for a long time, and they were rediscovered. And in the late 60s, I ran a film society there, and we showed a whole summer of Keaton films, and the audience was just knocked out by how great he is. And I remember debating with one of my mentor was a graduate student who was a very smart guy, and he thought Chaplin was too sentimental. He preferred Keaton, which was becoming the kind of conventional wisdom. I've always liked both of them. I think there's no law that says you have to choose one or the other. I think they're both great.
Joe, you didn't read the bylaws in the Cinephiliac Guide. You must choose.
It is like a law in the, But I asked Howard Hawks, for example, when I did my book, Hawks on Hawks, Keaton's name came up because I thought he's like Hawks in some ways. He's sort of tough and resilient and ingenious like Hawks' characters. And I asked him how much, he liked Keaton. He said, I like him, but I like Chaplin more. And I said, I was surprised you like him more because Chaplin is more sentimental than you are. And he said, that's why I like him, because I can't do that kind of thing.
I obviously love them both, but I must confess, I am, if I had to choose, I'd be in the Keaton camp.
Keaton is an amazingly inventive director, and he seems more modern in a sense, because Chaplin is sort of Victorian in his sensibility, and he grew up in London in the Victorian era, and came from the music halls of London, and he's somewhat old-fashioned with his plots to some extent. And there is the sentimentality, which is, seems old-fashioned in some ways. But It's so beautiful in City Lights, but he mixes it in with humor too. So it's not painful to watch the sentiment like it is in some silent films. You know, that really seem old fashioned. Chaplin's films seem very lively, and in City Lights, okay, yeah, he's in love with a blind girl, which could be sort of an icky situation or something, but he makes it very pure and very charming. And there's a wonderful moment when he first meets her, which is a great scene, and he realizes she's blind, and he becomes very gentle and gracious toward her, and he's sort of awestruck by her. And then he kind of, she mistakes him for the rich man at that point, because she hears the door slamming and she thinks he's going away in his limousine. So he tiptoes away, and he sits there and he kind of moons over her. And then she comes with, she goes to a water fountain with a bucket for her flowers, and she throws the old water away into his face, which is a wonderful moment. Martin Scorsese said that was the moment when he was a kid, when he saw that, he realized Chaplin was the greatest of all filmmakers, when she throws the water in Chaplin's face. Because you have this, the height of emotion and beauty, and then suddenly this comic, low comedy scene that just changes the mood completely. It's a wonderful piece of direction.
Absolutely. Yeah, you mentioned that this was kind of a latecomer in the what we now call silent film. I don't know. It's not a genre, but it's a...
Well, it's a whole...
It's a whole other medium, essentially.
Way of life,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. But this kind of the last gasp of it, essentially, at least in America. But what can you talk a little bit more about Chaplin's resistance to talkies, or to dialogue, because he sort of embraces the audio aspects of filmmaking. Obviously, he added the sound effects and he composed the score. So he obviously saw that component of filmmaking as one that he was willing to embrace, but just not dialogue.
Yeah, he calls the film City Lights, in the title it says a comedy, romance, and pantomime. So he was telling his audience, okay, this is going to be pantomime. He loved pantomime, and it is a beautiful art form. And Mary Pickford had a great line. She said it would have been more logical if silent films had grown out of talking pictures instead of the other way around, which is a wonderful thought. The silent art was very perfect. It reached a sort of state of perfection in the late 20s. And I think, I don't know, if I had to pick the greatest decade of filmmaking, I'd say the 1920s. It was an amazingly fertile period. So when you see a film like Sunrise, which is astounding in its visual splendor and genius, or the City Lights, which is dramatically, visually more simple, but the human emotions are extremely complex. It really is the art of filmmaking in its highest form, because Hitchcock would scorn what he called pictures of people talking, you know. And I think he was making a point too emphatically. There's nothing wrong with good dialogue and people talking. He has a lot of good scenes in his films that are people talking with each other. In Psycho, there's a 9-minute great scene between Janet Leigh and Tony Perkins right before he kills her, where they're having a kind of a heart-to-heart conversation that's really powerful. But, you know, a lot of the great moments in Hitchcock are silent. Like, you know, the directors that came from silent films, John Ford, Hawks, Capra, Hitchcock, always had long silent sequences and they're talking pictures, and then combine it with music. But there's this purity to the art form that's nonverbal that is something very special. And I remember when I was in college, we were reading early film theory books and things. A lot of people lamented the death of silent films as sort of being the death of the art form. And that didn't prove to be true, because a lot of directors, people like Ford, Hawks, and Capra, became better directors actually with the addition of sound, because they were all very good with dialogue and it added something to their films. And Ford said, he wrote an article in the late 20s that he welcomed the coming of sound because a director could add music to his films and control the soundtrack. That was very important to him, because he said otherwise you'd be dependent on the organist or the piano player whatever they would put on the film, but this way he could pick the music himself. The early sound films didn't have dialogue. They had scores, or they had a mixture of dialogue and scores like The Jazz Singer. Mm-hmm. But Chaplin loved music. He did compose the scores, although in City Lights, the theme song about the flower girl, it was written by a man named Jose Padilla, and he actually sued Chaplin because he didn't give him credit for it originally. Chaplin ripped off this guy's popular song about a flower girl. So Chaplin was not the most original musician in the history of the world, but that was an important aspect of his films that he did control all through his career. And he loved conducting the orchestra and all that. And the scores are very charming in his films. Not the most, they're not Bernard Herrmann level, but they're good. So I think he felt, also it's often said that he didn't think the tramp should talk. Maybe because the public had gotten used to the tramp from 1914 onward. So there had been, 17 years there with the tramp being the most famous character in films. Chaplin was the most famous person in film history. As Kevin Brownlow said when he went on the set of Countess from Hong Kong, Chaplin's last film in the 60s, he said, "Finally, I meet the most important figure in the history of cinema." And Chaplin was the most famous man in the world. He was one of the richest people in films, most commercially successful. He was making $100,000 a week in 1918, if you can imagine that.
No.
It's kind of astounding when you think. And whenever he went somewhere, tens of thousands of people would mob him. He was the first gigantic movie star. I mean, Douglas Fairbanks was around the same time too, but Chaplin was the big star. So it's kind of hard, I think, for people to accept the tramp talking. He never really did. In modern times, he sings, and in The Great Dictator, he has a tramp-like character, but he's not the tramp, this Jewish guy who is mistaken for Hitler, basically. I mean, it's a satire of Adolf Hitler, and he plays the Hitler character, too. But that's not the tramp, exactly, but he's tramp-like in some of the scenes. And then he made a radical departure from that with Monsieur Verdoux after the war, where he played a lady killer, literally, and based on Landru, the French murderer, and the public violently reacted against it. It was a sophisticated dialogue comedy, black comedy, as we call it today. And the public really didn't like seeing him in such a different part, especially being a murderer. They found that very strange.
Do you know if the flower scenes in Monsieur Verdoux are callbacks to City Lights?
Well, I hadn't thought about that. That's an interesting point, isn't it? Because he's a connoisseur of roses. He clips roses, and he sort of celebrates each murder by cutting a rose bush.
Dude. Yeah. I don't know if that was – I didn't actually read about it, but it occurred to me.
That's interesting. Well, artists have their motifs and their obsessions, and Ford uses flowers in many different ways. But certainly when – the thing about Verdoux that's interesting is that he's kind of a sophisticated, urbane – charming guy, and yet he just happens to every once in a while kill a woman,
As you do.
Yeah, and he's a psychopath, although there's a scene at the end where he kind of defends himself by saying that, I'm a small-time murderer compared to people who run countries and fight wars. This was right after World War II, and he was trying to draw a kind of, why do we get so upset about some guy who's a serial killer when hundreds of thousands or millions of people get killed and Henry Kissinger gets the Nobel Peace Prize or whatever, people didn't like to hear that. And then he did Limelight, which is a powerful film about an old comedian on the stage.
Yeah, that's his old man movie.
Yeah, with Buster Keaton is in it with him.
Right.
And then King of New York, where he plays an exiled... Well, he plays a king who comes from a small country who comes to New York trying to raise money for his country and is accused of being a communist. This was during the McCarthy period, and Chaplin was blacklisted, and he was a leftist. He wasn't a communist, but he was supported a lot of left-wing causes, and so he was a big target of the witch hunters, and he was the only member of the Directors Guild ever to be expelled. Can you believe that?
Charlie Chaplin got expelled.
From the Directors Guild, yeah.
that's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, let's get rid of the greatest of all films. And he went to he got on the boat and he was going to England, and they, while he was on the ocean, they took away his visa. He was always a British citizen too. He never became an American citizen, which bothered people a great deal. They thought he was not loyal to the United States, which had treated him well up to a point. But he also got involved in a paternity case, which was trumped up charges, but the public held that against him. And so while he was en route back to London, where he came from, he couldn't return to the United States. And his wife, Una, had to come back, sneak back to Hollywood and take their money out of the bank. They had $5 million in the bank, and she smuggled it back out of the country, and he became an exile. And in 1972, the Academy brought him back for a special Oscar. He had won a special Oscar for The Circus, but never a competitive Oscar. And so they had to get a special visa for him, and the U.S. government would only give him a two-week visa. And one of his daughters said, when he heard that, he was delighted by that. He said, "Oh, they're still afraid of me. That's so great, you know." Yeah. And, but he was a thorn in the side of a lot of people in the United States. And part of it was, as Rossellini said about King of New York, he said, "It's the film of a free man," which I thought was a great comment. It's an attack on McCarthyism, and it's a very anti-American film. And it's a film of outrage against the House Un-American Activities Committee and the various kinds of people who'd been persecuting him. And it's a very brave film. He made it in London with his own money. He was rich enough he could make his own films. That's another thing that's wonderful about him, is he was so wealthy that he was the only really totally independent filmmaker in Hollywood long before that term existed, because he paid for his own films. He owned his own studio. He starred in the films. He wrote the films. He directed the films. He did the music. And he started United Artists with Griffith and Pickford and Fairbanks. So he owned his own distribution company. So he totally was free and independent, if anybody was. I mean, he still had to worry about making money with his films, but he spent $1.5 million on City Lights, which is a lot in that period. And but he was successful. And so he kept doing that even in the 50s when he was in exile. He could still make a film on his own every once in a while. And some of those films weren't shown in the U.S. for a long time, though.
Right. Makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Back to The Tramp, though. How did that character evolve? He didn't start off wearing a bowler hat. Obviously, he was in his Keystone Cops days. I imagine he was probably mostly wearing a cop uniform. But can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of The Tramp?
Well, he came from the music hall, and also then he was, as you say, with Max Sennett, and he did some different kinds of films, Tilly's Punctured Romance and things. And he sort of put the Tramp costume together kind of on the spur of the moment. And he first appeared in Kid Auto Races in Venice was a film where he played the Tramp in 1914. And he talked about just kind of messing around in the makeup room and finding different props and putting them together, kind of an inspired thing that was improvised. And I guess it, you know, people have traced the roots of the Tramp back to, you know, the Greek figure, the god Pan, for example. He's like, somebody wrote a book called The Great God Pan, which was about Charlie Chaplin. So there are antecedents in theater and mythology and everything for his character, but it became a unique personal creation. A lot of it had to do with his great acquaintance with poverty. He had a very impoverished Dickensian upbringing. His mother went mad and went into an insane asylum, and he and his brother Sidney were in an orphanage, and it was quite a grim life. So he really empathized with homeless people, poor people, and that's part of what made him popular, and that's why he was a leftist. He was on the side of the working man or the poor man. Actually, the Tramp is not exactly a working man. He's kind of a layabout or a bum who's sponging on people and stuff. But he's self-reliant, and he can live on the streets and live by his wits, and that's very appealing to people. Mm-hmm. And that part of that came. And I was reading, somebody mentioned that the blind girl in City Lights. Well, some of Chaplin's heroines have some affliction. And the guy was tracing this to Chaplin's mother being insane. And, if you grow up with troubled family or background, you create metaphors for that. In watching City Lights, one of the things that I found surprising, I hadn't ever thought of it this way before, there's something a little disturbing about the fact that she's blind because, you know, she's very sweet, she's beautiful, and she's charming, and it brings out his graciousness and his sensitivity that he takes care of her and all that. But there's something about a woman being totally helpless that is kind of creepy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's totally under his control in a sense, even though she goes out and sells flowers for a living. But she is, you know, it's about deception to some extent because he's deceiving her about who he really is, which is kind of disturbing too, because he's worried that if she finds out he's a bum, that, she won't like him. So that has that class anxiety thing going on that is part of the tramp situation. There's a social consciousness to Chaplin's films because the tramp is treated or mistreated in society, and so-called respectable people look down on him in City Lights, et cetera, and the policemen are always chasing him. And that's very appealing to viewers then and now. But having a woman under his complete control is kind of disturbing. And he was known for his womanizing and his penchant for young girls. And Virginia Sherrill, the woman who stars in City Lights, said in some interview, somebody said, "Did you have a romantic attachment with Chaplin?" She said, "No, I was too old for him. I was 20 years old at the time."
Yeah.
It's kind of disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And good night, ladies and gentlemen. And it's a good, yet another example of the more you know about your heroes, the less you like them, you know?
Well, as a person, he had some serious disturbing things going on, as do a lot of comedians.
Right.
And we could mention other ones. But he was, he brought this into his art form, and City Lights is also about identity, I think, and that's a very immigrant concern. It's immigrants are always very concerned about how they fit in with society, and you know, you're an Englishman or you're an Italian or Irishman or whatever you are, and you come to the United States, and are you an American? He was kind of an American, but he was, as I said, attacked for not taking American citizenship. Although when World War I came, he led bond drives and brought in millions of dollars for the war effort and things. So he did things like that. It's not like he hated America or anything, but people resented the fact that he didn't just change his allegiance totally. But, you know, it's hard sometimes if you're born somewhere, you don't want to give up your citizenship, perhaps. You want to stay what you are. But that causes conflicts. And so some of the conflicts can be seen in City Lights. Who is this guy? You know, she thinks he's a millionaire. He masquerades as a millionaire. And there's kind of an elaborate device. She lives with her grandmother, and you might wonder how come the grandmother never sees him and says, "Wait a second, he's a tramp." So they have to have a scene where it's explained that she's always gone when he happens to come in, which is kind of tricky, you know.
Convenient.
Yeah. But he's also terrified of her finding out that he's a bum because he's obviously got anxiety about his self-worth. And that's another... that goes beyond being an immigrant. Immigrants have anxieties about their social status, and that's part of Chaplin's driving force. But also on a very deep human level, Andrew Serres made a comment I always remembered, that the last shot of City Lights where he's just staring at the flower girl, she recognizes him, as you say, by her touch. You know, she touches his hand, and she realizes, it's very beautifully acted, she realizes who he is, and then she says, "You?" And he nods shyly. And it's very enigmatic because you don't know what her reaction is going to be. She's very grateful to him, but she realizes who he really is. And Sarah said this, "What is the ending of City Lights but the drama of a man who feels unworthy of being loved, you know, by the person he loves?"
Mm.
And that's, I think, why it haunts people so much. It fades out in the shot of him looking at her with this sort of smile that has a lot of anguish and anxiety connected with it. And we don't know what's going to happen to these people. He leaves it up in the air, you know?
Yeah. Do you think they live happily ever after?
I don't think you get that feeling. You know, I think you have the feeling that, I mean, the tramp is not going to change who he is. He's kind of stuck being a tramp in that costume. And he tries to break into high society a few times in the film. He has part of the comic plot is that the millionaire friend that he makes is an alcoholic, and when the guy is drunk, he loves the tramp and their friends, and when he's sober, he doesn't recognize them at all, right, which is very interesting, because that's not only is it like schizophrenia on this guy's part, but it shows the relationship of society to the tramp that's completely irrational and schizoid, that sometimes they love him, sometimes they don't even know who he is, you know? Mm-hmm. And from my study of Frank Capra, that was one of his big anxieties, was being considered a nobody or a nothing.
Before we started recording, you'd mentioned to me that some have suggested that Capra's The Strong Man might have served as some inspiration for City Lights.
People have suggested this, and it seems plausible. 1926 film, Chaplin was working on The Circus, and then while he was doing The Circus, he thought of City Lights, and the germ of it was a blind girl being in love with a tramp, and he thought of the ending, actually. It was one of the first things he thought of, and Capra had made this film in which Harry Langdon plays an immigrant, and Langdon was a quirky, unique comedian, but he had certain traits that were kind of Chaplin-esque, a kind of funny little guy who was had a funny walk, and he was oddball in society, and he comes over from Belgium. He fights in World War One, and Langdon and Capra were both influenced by Chaplin, and the opening in World War One of The Strong Man reminds you of Shoulder Arms, which is a famous Chaplin comedy about World War One. And then he comes to America and he meets this blind girl played by Priscilla Bonner, who's a lovely, very intelligent actress who I interviewed a couple times about John Ford and Frank Capra. And she's very charming and very wholesome and sweet compared to a lot of the kind of crooked people he's been meeting in America. So she appeals to him on that level. And so they have a very touching romance, and she never gets cured of her blindness, though. But this could very well have inspired Chaplin. It was a very successful film and made Capra's reputation. And it's obviously Chaplin would have known about The Strong Man. So I'd say that's a very good possibility. He was influenced by that. He wouldn't admit that, I'm sure.
Yeah. You also mentioned to me that you use City Lights as kind of a teaching tool in your screenwriting class.
Yeah.
Which seems an interesting choice, given that there, again, no dialogue.
I use it. The first class of, I teach basic screenwriting every semester, and I've done that for 14 years now at San Francisco State. And when I start the semester, I show some clips to show what screenwriting is all about. And there's a wonderful documentary called Unknown Chaplin by Kevin Brownlow and David Gill from 1983. They were allowed access by Una, Lady Chaplin, into Chaplin's archives, and he kept all his films very carefully preserved. That's one reason they look so good today, that he had the money to preserve them, and he realized they were valuable. And he also saved all the outtakes and things. So they put together this three-part series based on outtakes, and one of the things they found was a home movie that one of his friends named Ralph Barton had shot of Chaplin directing City Lights. And it's 9 minutes long, and you can see it on the Criterion Blu-ray of City Lights. They have the whole unedited thing. But what Brownlow and Gill did was walk you through how he composed the sequence of the tramp meeting the flower girl for the first time, which is crucial to the whole film. And it was very difficult for Chaplin to figure out how to do that, to convey how does she mistake him for a blind man. And also, how do you convey that she's blind, first of all? Then how do you convey that he figures that out? That's hard enough. But then to show that she mistakes him for a millionaire, it really was really agonizing for him. And he actually shot that sequence five times over. He shot 342 takes for a three-minute sequence film. And so they have all the outtakes, and so they're kind of showing you how he's working on different approaches to it and moving the characters around in the setting of the street corner and all that. And then at one point he had this inspiration to add a sound effect, which was door slamming, that the tramp is, he sees a policeman and he's kind of, the way he meets the flower girl, he sneaks through a car and he comes out And so she thinks that he's a guy coming out of a fancy car. And then as he's staring at her after he buys the flower, a real rich man comes and gets in the car and the door slams. He drives off and she thinks that's him going away. So it's very clear when you see the film, but to imagine a sequence like that, as I tell my students in your apartment in Santa Monica, would be mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Try to work that out. What Chaplin did was he didn't write scripts in the normal sense of the word. He would have an outline. He'd have detailed notes, but he would make up the film as he shot. And he had the money and the time. Most people don't have, 3 years to make a film and unlimited footage and everything. They have to have a script, but he had the luxury of working it out on the set with the actors, and that, so this is a form of screenwriting to compose it visually. And so I'm trying to teach the students to think visually. D.W. Griffith was asked how to write a screenplay. He said, "Think in pictures." Mm-hmm. And so Chaplin is composing a screenplay, but he's doing it on the set with the actors and with himself and the actress, and he's doing it shot by shot.
Yet another thing he and Godard have in common. That must be where he got it.
Yeah.
Oh, and it cometh again. No.
But the other thing that's funny in that sequence is that Chaplin blamed Virginia Cherryl for a lot of the problems because he said she couldn't even hold up a flower properly. And if you look at it, you shouldn't believe everything you hear in a documentary because she holds up a flower perfectly,
Right.
And it shows him showing her how to do it. He's the kind of director who would act out the parts. But this is a director putting the blame on the actor rather than on his problems of inspiration.
Right.
Which is worth remembering, too, that directors like to blame other people for their problems. But it all worked out, but they didn't get along very well because of this. He fired her at one point, and he thought she was kind of an amateur and that she was kind of dilatory. But she said it was very boring doing this because literally there'd be months would go by where they wouldn't shoot. Chaplin would be at home agonizing or trying to figure out what to do next, and nobody would work. They'd all be on salary. But sometimes she said they'd go to the studio and sit there all day and she'd do needlepoint in her dressing room or read books and nothing happened,
Not a bad gig,
Yeah.
It could be worse.
Yeah, it could be worse.
But if he's berating her and giving her a hard time about holding how she holds flowers, maybe it's not so fun. But
the incident was she came in late one day because she said she had her hair done at a salon and he exploded and fired her. It was one of those trivial incidents that he thought she was unprofessional. So he brought in Georgia Hale, who had been the leading lady in The Gold Rush, who was his girlfriend at the time. And you can actually see he reshot the ending with Georgia Hale for City Lights. And she's pretty good, but she's not Virginia Cherryl. There's some kind of glow about Virginia Cherryl that's really beautiful and sweet. And perhaps her lack of slickness and lack of being a professional actor works for that film. And so he came to his senses and realized he had shot so much footage with her, he better let her finish the film. And he hired her back, but she demanded more money and got a raise.
Good for her.
Yeah. Then she married Cary Grant.
Right, exactly. Yeah, what does one do when they're a leading lady and marry Cary Grant? Of course. Yeah. That didn't end
that
well.
That didn't last too long.
Yeah.
Last too long, but she had a good life. She was a socialite, actually, a kind of well-off young lady.
Yeah, you once you marry Cary Grant, you're in, I guess.
well, his marriages didn't tend to last.
Well, I wonder why. Anyway, we won't go there. Yeah. but let's talk about the structure of the film, because I think I know that most of the time when I think of this film, I think about the ending, because it's so impactful. Just a total knockout. But there's also a scene with a more literal knockout. There's an amazing set piece sort of towards the middle where Charlie Chaplin is in a boxing match, and it's astounding.
It's hilarious. It's one of the greatest slapstick moments in silent films. And W.C. Fields once said when he went to see a Chaplin film, he said, "Son of a bitch is a ballet dancer."
He is, absolutely. Yeah, and it's funny because it's like, we have this boxing match and also this, and that's hysterical. But we also, again, have this heartbreaking story of poverty and hardship. So how does he balance that tonally? I mean, it's kind of a delicate kind of, I'm really not quite sure how he pulls it off.
Well, he does it so well. That's part of what makes him such a good director, that he, like I mentioned, that thing that Scorsese admired, that he ended this very sentimental scene by having her throw water in the guy's face by accidentally. And he couldn't react to it because she's blind and it wasn't her fault. So it's funny, you know.
Yeah.
So he was a master of that kind of change of pace. And there are a number of great comic set pieces in the film. There's a terrific scene at a nightclub that's funny, where he and the millionaire are both drunk and they're doing ridiculous things, and it's really funny. But the boxing sequence is quite long and a tremendous choreography. I don't even know how they did it. I was trying to study the shots because he often does some very long takes, sometimes even with dolly shots, which is unusual for him. And the gag is that Chaplin is desperate to get some money for the flower girl, so he takes a job to try to get $50 in the boxing ring, but he's kind of a puny weakling, and he thinks he's going to get slaughtered. So he makes a deal with one of the boxers that they won't hurt each other and they'll split the money. But then the guy has to leave, and this really tough guy comes in, and Chaplin tries to make the same deal with him, and he sort of looks at him and scorns him. And so Chaplin does all these sort of effete gestures toward him, like a kind of mincing and looking, you know, wiggling his eyebrows and stuff. And the guy's looking at him. It's very funny. There's a lot of sort of humor about homophobia in the film, actually, mm-hmm. because Chaplin is often, he's kind of like a guy with Asperger's syndrome who's grabbing the millionaire, hugging him, kissing him and stuff. And the millionaire is kind of freaking out. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to do that with the boxer, and the boxer is looking at him. But what he's trying to do, this is a classic comedy routine, is please don't hurt me. You know, he's acting like I'm a weakling and I'm really a sweet guy, so don't hurt me, you know.
Right.
But the guy's not having it, so he's really terrified. And he goes in the ring, and so his whole strategy in the ring is not to get hit. And so he's kind of running around behind the referee. So they have these amazing shots where the two boxers and the referee are kind of doing a whole ballet dance, in effect. And the other boxer can't even reach around the referee to hit him.
Right.
Then they start hitting the referee and stuff. And then they start hitting each other almost by mistake. And then Chaplin actually unloads some good punches. And it's really a wonderfully worked out sequence and really terrific. But he doesn't win the fight either. And so, I mean, there's some things in the film, like the fact that she gets cured of blindness is sort of magical. It's kind of far-fetched. You don't just go to Vienna and get cured of blindness, which is what happens in the film. And I mentioned in Strongman, she doesn't get cured. There's never even any talk about that. It's more realistic. But there's something, you want her to get cured. You know, you want her to have that magical change. On the other hand, that what's poignant about it is that then she can see who he is, and so that brings up his greatest fears, and he thinks he's going to lose her, and he actually tries to say goodbye to her, and he's it's very depressing in a way, because mm-hmm. he's you know, on the street, and he's not going to look her up, and she's laughing at him in a sort of condescending way, which is painful. She doesn't know who he is at first. And he starts staring at her. It's a really wonderful shot where he's kind of enraptured by her, and she laughs and turns to her mother and says, "Look, I've made a conquest."
Yeah.
So there's a lot of astringency and pain in the film, and the comedy is painful too, in a sense, because of it revolves around things like drunkenness or getting knocked out in the prize ring, or
suicide.
Yeah, the millionaire is trying to commit suicide. You know, there's a lot of suffering and pain behind the comedy, and I think maybe that's why it kind of works, because it's not just pure knockabout farce. There's emotional things happening in the comedy too.
Yes, absolutely. I think let's go to the final question for this topic. It is the 50th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll.
Yeah.
Is it worthy of the 50th spot? Should it be higher? Should it be lower?
I could imagine it being number one or number 10. I mean, it's so arbitrary in a way to put numerical rankings on films. And I was one of the people who participated in that poll, and I'm embarrassed to say I didn't put City Lights on my top 10. What I tried to do is pick my favorite directors and then pick the film by each one that meant the most to me. With Wells, I wound up with two, Chimes of Midnight and Magnificent Ambersons, and poor Chaplin, I didn't put him on the list. I think back in my college days, City Lights probably was always on my top 10. If I had to pick my top 20, I'd certainly put City Lights on there. It's sublime in a way that very few films are. But again, it was very hard picking 10 films. So, you know, 50 seems kind of low to me. It should be higher. There is a kind of a tendency to devalue silent films, and it shouldn't be. But the film is very celebrated and loved by many filmgoers. And I remember I once saw it in Madison, Wisconsin, at a theater. And as the final scene was going on, you know how sometimes they'll close the curtain before the film is over?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
Projectionist hit the button and the curtain started closing over the shot of Chaplin looking at the girl. I think the curtain started coming down and the shot of her before. And some guy in the audience started screaming.
Yeah.
Like he jumped up and started protesting and other people started yelling too, you know. So that shows you the passion that film inspires among film goers who love the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I totally agree. It should. I don't know if I don't know if I'd put it in my top 10, but I think it's higher than number 50 for sure.
Yeah, and it deserves any acclaim it gets, and so it's one of the landmarks of film history for sure.
As I mentioned in the intro, our guest, Joe McBride, has been keeping himself very busy. There are books and interviews and commentary tracks all on the horizon. And very happy that Joe is here to give us a sneak peek of some of the projects he has coming down the pike. I think the one that I've heard the most about from our listeners is the Chimes at Midnight Criterion. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, Chimes of Midnight is one of my favorite films. It's Orson Welles' Falstaff film. It's a great, very personal, very passionate, very beautiful, very eloquent film that has been seen by very few people. And as I did an interview for the Blu-ray edition that's coming out in August, it's been a long-awaited edition because this film has been missing for a long time. Never came out in DVD in the United States. There are some foreign editions that come and go, but it was out on VHS briefly. But very few people saw it on its first run. It was killed basically by Bosley Crowther, the New York Times, who wrote two negative reviews, and the distributor lost faith in the film. I actually, when I was 19 years old, I called the distributor. His name was Carl Peppercorn, at this little company in New York. He took a chance on it, even though Crowther had panned it in Cannes. And I was complaining to Mr. Peppercorn, how come you're not distributing this film more? And he seemed very irked that this 19-year-old kid was bugging him. But he said he had lost faith in it because Crowther panned it again, and basically he gave up on the film. So I saw it three times in one night in Chicago, and as I mentioned in my interview, what struck me, the theater was near the University of Chicago, so the audience was kind of half intellectuals from the University of Chicago and film buffs, and half winos off the street. And the winos loved the film, and they got the humor. And so you don't have to be a Shakespearean expert to love the film, because it's very accessible. And Falstaff is sort of the king of the winos, king of the bums. And it's a tragedy also about his relationship to Prince Hal, who becomes the king and has to decide whether he should maintain his friendship with him or not. It's very painful, and very great performance by Wells. Keith Baxter is great as Prince Hal. Last year I had the great pleasure of going to Spain. There was a Wells conference, and Esteve Riamba, who organized it, who runs the Barcelona Film Archive, has written a book on Chimes of Midnight. He took us all on a field trip to Cardona, which is a village where Wells had shot 30% of the film. And they have this old church, which was built in the 800s by a count named Wilfred the Hairy. I love that name. And
that's a great name.
Yeah, Wilfred the Hairy. Thank you, Wilfred. You should get a credit on the film. But he built this fantastic castle church, and Wells used that as the royal court of the king, played by John Gielgud. And so we accompanied Keith Baxter, Prince Hal. I never thought I would, when I was a kid seeing Chimes of Midnight in Chicago, that I would one day be touring the castle with Prince Hal. You know, it was a really wonderful thing. So Criterion is finally, this film was tied up for a long time in rights squabbles between the families of the late producers were arguing between themselves. And there wasn't much interest in the film in America because nobody knew about it. But a lot of film buffs have been clamoring for it for years. And so the Spanish archives did a restoration. It turned out the negative was in Paris and was deteriorating, so it needed some restoration. There was some sound problems that they've corrected. And it looks really good. It sounds really good. And I saw it at Film Forum last year, and they've been working more on it. Criterion has improved the restoration from what I saw a year ago. Yeah, so it looks really beautiful. I think it will be a big event for anybody who loves film. And as I say at the end of my interview, when I run into people who say Welles was a tragic failure and his career collapsed, I always have one question: have you seen Chimes of Midnight? And the answer invariably is no.
Yeah.
Because if you saw that film, you wouldn't think he's a tragic failure. This is 1966. He really made his greatest film in 1966.
Well, that's a bold claim. I guess people are just going to have to check out the DVD and see for themselves. That's coming out in late August, right?
Yeah, the Blu-ray. It's actually Blu-ray and looks gorgeous.
Blu-ray, that's crazy.
It has some good extras. And it'll be a really wonderful thing. And I also did I've done some audio commentaries recently. And in August as well, there's a John Ford film. I did one for Three Bad Men, which... is another pretty obscure film. Most people have never heard of it, but I think it's Ford's best surviving silent film. He made a lot of silent films, and a lot of them are lost. But of the 25 that exist in whole or in part, the best I've seen is Three Bad Men. It's a terrific film about a land rush, one of those great land rushes where people were out west, pioneers going west, and George O'Brien stars in it, who was Ford's leading man for a number of years. And Priscilla Bonner, who I mentioned earlier, who was in The Strong Man, is in Three Bad Men. It's a beautiful film, beautiful Western pictorially, and very charming, very relaxed. His most famous Western in that period is The Iron Horse, which is a big epic, but I find that kind of laborious. It's got some spectacular production values and great epic scenery and things, but the story is pretty... dime novel kind of silly story, whereas Three Bad Men has a more relaxed feeling to it. It's not striving for, to impress you too much. It's just a good movie, and it's a very enjoyable story with a lot of humor. It's about three kind of trampy ruffian characters who sacrifice themselves for this young couple. Mm-hmm. And Ford loves that theme. He made Three Godfathers.
Right, that was immediately what I thought of.
Yeah, 1948 is a beautiful color film, Three Godfathers, which he had filmed in the silent period as Marked Men. It was based on a novella by Peter B. Kine. It's been filmed a number of times. It's a classic story of three outlaws who find a dying woman with a baby in the wilderness and redeem themselves by rescuing the baby. And that's the kind of sort of an inspiration for Three Bad Men. These three guys are kind of like godfathers, and there's a sort of religious theme going on, and self-sacrifice, which is a big theme in John Ford. So it's a beautiful film, and I think people will be delighted and impressed to discover that film as well.
That's all fantastic, but I know we've discussed, there were a number of things we discussed on our previous collaboration. I don't know about your previous appearance on FlixWise, the Some Like It Hot episode. We got into a detailed discussion about your recently published memoir, The Broken Places.
Yeah.
And so I just want to remind listeners really quickly that they can still purchase that book on Amazon, right? It's self-published.
Yeah, that's right. It's on Amazon, and that's the great thing about it. Is a labor of love I worked on for a long, long time, and tells the story of my troubled youth and the girl I was in love with who was more troubled than I was. And it's a very personal, very bittersweet book. But it's great to have Amazon there to distribute the book throughout the world. Anybody who wants to get it can get it there.
Mm-hmm. And then just one last thing. When we last spoke, You were busy working on a critical study of Ernst Lubitsch, and I'm hoping you can offer listeners a good update. You have happy news for us.
Well, happy news is I finished writing the book.
That is always happy news. That's always cause for celebration.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Took 7 years, although somebody said to me at one point, why is this book taking so long? And I said, well, you know, I've done 5 other books in that period, you know.
Yeah, you've been busy.
I've been busy here.
Yeah.
But this has been a labor of love again, because Lubitsch was considered, you know, a very famous, very beloved director in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and he was kind of a household name like Hitchcock or Capra. And now he's kind of forgotten, although film buffs love Trouble in Paradise and Shop Around the Corner, Heaven Can Wait. But he made many, many films that people haven't seen. He made a lot of films in Germany before he came to America. He had the rare distinction of being considered the most important director in 2 different cultures, Germany and the United States. And he was tremendously influential and the master of the romantic comedy, more or less invented that genre and more or less invented the musical. And Orson Welles said he said Lubitsch is a giant. His talent and originality are stupefying, he said. And so I wanted to pay tribute to him and express my love and appreciation for his comedy and romance and try to explain how he did it. Billy Wilder had a sign on the wall of his office, "How would Lubitsch do it?" So I call it my book, "How did Lubitsch do it?" Mm-hmm. The films of Ernst Lubitsch. So he's had a number of books written about him. Some are okay, but there hasn't been one that deals with the whole of his career in both countries. And I had to go to Europe 3 times to see a lot of these films because you can't see them in America. And so I trace his evolution and his roots and his flowering in the 20s as a great Hollywood director soon after he came to Hollywood. And one of the things to tie it in with City Lights is that he was greatly influenced by Chaplin's film A Woman of Paris, which came out in 1923. It's an amazingly good film. And it was the first film Chaplin directed in which he didn't play a major part. He had a little bit part, but it's a bittersweet comedy romance, kind of unclassifiable film, like very much like a Lubitsch film. And it's wonderfully directed and very sophisticated. And Lubitsch was influenced by that in a Swedish film, Eroticon. Those films helped stimulate him. He had already made some very good comedies in Germany, but he... it sort of crystallized his method and his way of looking at the world and cinema. When he saw Chaplin's Woman of Paris, he was head over heels with admiration. Shortly after seeing Woman of Paris, Lubitsch made The Marriage Circle in 1924, which is a really great silent film that people should see. So I'm hoping to make Lubitsch a household name again. That's my goal, as I and a few other people have done for John Ford. When I've written books on Ford twice, he was out of fashion and kind of forgotten about it. You know, often I would say I'm working on a book about John Ford or I love John Ford, and I would get this blank stare from people, which is a horrible feeling. And I get that same blank stare now when I say Ernst Lubitsch, you know, most people. Hmm? Yeah. So I always preface it by saying the great German-American director Ernst Lubitsch, and they kind of look at me like they really don't know who he is, but oh, okay. Yeah. But I'm hoping, and this is a lot to achieve with one book, but I'm trying to get people to be more aware of him and maybe get some video companies to release more of his films on DVD. Some of the major Lubitsch films have never been released in America on DVD. And so he's a rediscovery. I often do books to try to bring attention on subjects who I think have been neglected or mistreated or abused or whatever, you know, and I think Lubitsch has been neglected and forgotten.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that is finished and that hopefully we will be able to read it for ourselves very soon.
Yeah, it's getting out there in the marketplace and hopefully be out there before too long. And I think people will enjoy it. And I really had a good time writing it, which is part of the selfish pleasure of the whole thing.
Of course. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, do you have a favorite Chaplin movie? Come tell us what it is on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can tell us on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. And if you've recently coerced a millionaire into giving you several thousands of dollars, and you're feeling generous, you can come and find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. Yes, I'm taking donations. And speaking of feeling generous, if you fancy yourself the charitable type, there's one big thing you can do for me, and it won't cost you a dime. Please go find FlixWise in the iTunes store and rate us and leave us a nice message. It'll really, really help us out. For our next Sight and Sound entry, we have tied with City Lights for the number 50 spot, Kenji Mizoguchi's Ugetsu. But until then, Joe, it's been a pleasure and an honor having you on again.
Well, it's always great fun to talk to you about movies. You're such a delightful conversationalist, and we always have great things to talk about and lively thoughts that occur to me from hearing you expound on these films. It's really a pleasure.
Why, thank you. And hopefully we can talk you into coming on again.
Anytime. I'd be very happy to do it. And there's so many great films out there, aren't there?
That's so true. And I think there are a number of Wells films coming up. And I don't know. Is there a fourth? We'll look. We'll take a look and see what we can snag you for.
Well, thank you so much. I'd love to come back anytime.
Perfect. Okay. Time to click our heels and head off into parts unknown. But until we meet again, so long, everyone.